Good morning. I'm Representative Dave Pinto. I'm the chair of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee, and I'm calling this meeting of the committee to order. Welcome to members of the public. You will find materials about this meeting, a meeting agenda, et cetera, on our committee website, so please check that out. I will note this meeting is being called pursuant to House Rule 10.01, which allows for virtual hearings of this type. Ms. Chambers, would you please take the roll?
Representative Pinto, chair.
Present.
Representative Pryor, vice chair.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Damon.
Present.
Representative Juergens.
Present.
Representative Cotiza-Witun.
Present.
Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Wazlowick.
Present.
And Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Chambers. And Representative Pryor, would you please move approval of the minutes from March 2nd?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Any additions or corrections to those minutes, members? I'm not hearing any. All in favor of approval of the March 2nd minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Not hearing any, the motion prevails. Minutes from March 2nd are approved. Excellent. And so, members, again, a pretty jam-packed day. And so I'm going to ask those who are here to testify and our colleagues, thank you so much for doing that. And I'll have to be fairly strict on time limits, and my apologies for that. We're starting off with a really exciting proposal relating to home visiting. And I want to note that just because of the way that this session is working, we're unfortunately hearing this informationally. What we have is a document that is being currently on its path to being jacketed. So I think the bill will be introduced very soon. But just because of the way the timing worked, we have to hear it this way. So again, apologies for that. And again, members of the public, all these materials are posted on our website. I know Representative Bonner, our colleague, former colleague from last term in early childhood, is here. And so we won't have a motion because there's not actually a bill in front of us. Representative Bonner, welcome to you. And if you can please introduce and describe the proposal, and we'll move on to your testifiers.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You know, I ran for office because I wanted to serve my community, to make a difference. It's the heart and soul of why we do the work we do as legislators. I wonder if we can find a way to just change the lives of those in our community, not just change their lives, but allow them to thrive. As legislators, we have the opportunity to impact profound change. In this committee, we understand the awe-inspiring value of a child's development in the first few years of life, their little brains developing, growing, their whole lives setting up before them. Their motor skills develop, their brain synapses flourish, their personalities and experience form the foundation of the road to come. It sets the stage for success in education and in life. But not every story starts with a happy beginning. Not every mother starts with the tools to love and nurture her little one, to realize the dream of who they could become. Not every family has the resources or the skills to help this new life reach its full potential. Members, we have before us a proposal with the power to change that. Home visiting is a program that has the power to shape futures by shaping and nurturing the families who are most at risk. Due to poverty, language barriers, substance abuse, and often the lack of skills to model the nurturing behaviors many never experienced in their own childhood. Home visiting has the power to mold generations to come. Today, you'll hear some success stories and one woman who found so much value, she felt compelled to share the foundation of what she learned with other families to form their futures together. Here's what we know. The need is real, the benefit profound. Nearly 90% of families we could help we'll never get it because we don't have the resources or the funds to intervene early. When we have the window of opportunity to change the trajectory of these young lives, COVID has laid bare the even more stark need in our communities for this vital work. I know the proposal before you asks for a huge commitment on our parts, as leaders and as legislators. But the value lies not just in the substantial savings that our state will receive down the road through early intervention. No, the real return on investment is the potential to raise multiple generations out of poverty, to slam the door on education gaps before they get a foot in the door, to impart the wisdom of mothers to find within themselves the skills to nurture their children and our future. Members, I'm asking us to lead by making all eligible families available to receive the services they so desperately need and the outcomes we so desperately want. Here are a few facts to bring it home. The bill increases current funding from $33 million to $278 million per biennium. This request closes the gap to reach the remaining 90% of eligible pregnant women and families with young children. That's nearly 81,000 more Minnesota families would be helped. This would position Minnesota as a national leader in providing voluntary home visiting services. COVID has disproportionately impacted high-risk families already struggling with employment, housing, and food insecurity, increased isolation, and mental health needs. The cost of inaction is steep. Traumatic experiences early in life can disrupt brain development, leading to poor health, emotional, behavioral, cognitive, and language development outcomes. These families grow and children grow up in families and show up in other programs not so worthy. In 2019, over 2,000 babies and 15,000 3- to 5-year-olds were victims of maltreatment. Many removed from their homes, entered the foster care system where they remain, causing further trauma. The benefits to families are compelling. Improved child health and development, increased parent-child attachment, 18% increases in kindergarten readiness, improved maternal outcomes, including decreased depression, 37% increases in employment, reduction in alcohol and drug use, decreases in child and abuse and maltreatment, and increased understanding of positive child development. These programs connect families to critical services that position them to thrive, not just survive. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'll turn it over to my testifiers to provide more in-depth information about home visiting services and the impact that it has on our families.
Thanks so much, Representative Bonner. And I should have noted at the beginning, members, you'll recall that we did have a presentation on home visiting in general quite a while back now from the Department of Health. So hopefully members have a good familiarity with that. And now this is building on it. LaSharian McDonald, I think, is our first testifier. If you can please, once you unmute, you can identify yourself and proceed. Get you. Ms. McDonald, can you hear us? You stayed unmuted. Oh, there you go. Yep, you're unmuted. So please identify yourself and begin.
Oh, I can't hear.
Ms. McDonald, are you?
Oh, hello?
I wonder if Ms. McDonald, can you hear me?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm having Zoom technical difficulties this morning. I can kind of hear you. Can you hear me?
I certainly can. And Zoom technical difficulties are a very common thing these days for many of us. We can hear you now. And so please, if you can just identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, chair members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you for requesting funding to support for voluntary home visiting services for all eligible families in Minnesota. My name is LaSharian McDonald, and I am a health educator and home visitor with St. Paul Ramsey County Public Health. And can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Yes. Okay, and I did receive home visiting services. So, I got pregnant in the 8th grade while I was 14 years old. Being a teen mom, you get your share of judgmental looks and comments. The awful looks and comments filled me with guilt, shame, and embarrassment. I was living in poverty when I got pregnant, so I had to get on welfare and sign up for WIC to make sure that I can provide for my baby when he was born. WIC referred me to Ramsey County Public Health so that I can receive home visiting services. I began meeting with my first public health nurse when I was pregnant throughout my son's first year. I moved out of Ramsey County, then came back when my son was almost 3 years old. Then I started receiving home visiting services from my second public health nurse. So during my visits with my first public health nurse, she would measure my stomach, weigh me, educate me on my unborn child and how he was developing in my womb. My first public health nurse was also supportive emotionally because she made sure we always had time to talk about what I was struggling with that week. After my son was born, my public health nurse would weigh my baby and do screenings to make sure he was on track developmentally. My public health nurse would also ask how I was coping with being a new mom and how she could be supportive. My second public health nurse would talk to me about parenting topics like health and nutrition and discipline and family well-being. She connected me to any resource that I need, such as food shelves, employment opportunities, and any mental health services. My public health nurse helped me to understand my child's development and his behaviors through child development screening methods. My public health nurse will also check in to see how I was doing as a person and how she could support me. So meeting with my public health nurses was always the highlight of my day. Home visiting was important to me because my public health nurses never judged me. When they looked at me, they didn't see just a teen mom. They saw a mom who was trying to raise her son while completing grade school on welfare. I felt listened to and heard during my home visits. My public health nurses educated me on the skills I needed to parent my child the best way I could. I felt like my public health nurses understood me because of the empathy they always displayed towards me. And my public health nurses helped me to finish school while being a teen mom by helping me to make sure my basic needs were met while also being emotionally supportive. After I graduated from high school, both of my public health nurses wrote me letters of recommendation to St. Catherine University. I graduated from St. Kate's in 2017, and now I'm employed at St. Paul Ramsey County Public Health, where my public health nurses worked. So the reason why I went to St. Kate's is because I was like, you know what? I want to do what my public health nurses are doing. They have really made a huge impact on my life, you know, because I'm officially out of poverty. I'm married now. Now I have two kids. And I feel like I'm a better mom, professional, and woman because of home visiting. So now as myself, now that I'm a home visitor, I love what I do. And I feel like I'm, you know, doing my part in the community. I feel like, you know, it's my turn now. I'm reaching my hand back and helping other young women get out of poverty with children. And I know a lot about what my clients are going through because I've walked in their shoes. And, you know, I just hope to be a reminder to moms that you can get out of poverty and raise your kids in a healthy way and live the life that you want to live against all odds. And, you know, I enjoy bonding with families and helping them get connected to resources that they need. I enjoy working with moms on building healthy attachment with their children, talking about child development and family well-being. And, you know, I truly feel like I'm making an impact on the families' lives that I serve, just like my public health nurses made an impact on my life. So, you know, family home visiting is, you know, is needed. Because like I said before, I feel like, you know, I'm the woman I am today because of that. You know, my public health nurses were a huge support in basically every area of my life. And they helped take some of the, you know, pressure off that I had as far as like living in poverty and being a single teen mom. They took some of that pressure off by being emotionally supportive and, you know, helped me to get my basic needs met, as I said before. So thank you all for your time.
And thank you. Thank you so much, Ms. McDonald, and thank you for sharing your experience. And as a St. Paul Ramsey County resident, let me thank you personally for your work for our community. Thanks so much. Nidra Robinson, you are up. I'm sorry, I guess we had a quick video we're going to be playing. Ms. LaCroix-DeLune, I think this is just a two-minute video, and so if we can have that played, then we'll move on to our final two testifiers. Make this work.
My name is Kyrea Cummings. I went to Agape Teen Pregnancy High School, and I met Sarah there. I was 16.
Hi! Hi! It's good to see you. How's the eating going and getting any good fruits and vegetables in there?
Yeah, she does really well. She does really good eating. And since she got, like, her own plates, her own little forks
and things like that.
Yeah, so she's fine.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. It's gotten easier. Like, now when she's upset or when she's sick, it's easier to handle.
She helped me with all the testing that I needed while I was pregnant, with getting to my doctor's appointments, diapers. Then there's, like, a breast milk resource because I breastfed. It was, like, resources for everything, everything that I needed. It was, like, she had it.
It was really remarkable to start working with her and to see her in school and to see her progress in her pregnancy. Just seeing her journey through that and to grow in confidence then as a parent and to also, you know, figure out childcare and to continue with her school, even though that can be hard with a young one at home. But she did it. It's really been remarkable. She's an incredible young woman and has really accomplished so much over these last few years.
After that, it was like, she kind of put me in the way so I got the hang of it. And then after I got the hang of it, I could do it on my own. So it was like, oh, I know how this goes. I got this now. I was 16 when I got pregnant with Kaden. I had her at 17. She is 4 now, and she's great. She's getting ready to go to kindergarten. She's so, so smart, and she's doing very, very well. She's the greatest blessing that I could have ever had.
If we can end the, thank you. So thank you so much, Mr. Robinson. You are up, and if you can identify yourself and proceed.
Yes. Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nidra Robinson, and I'm the Early Childhood Program Manager at Simpson Housing Services. Simpson Housing Services is a nonprofit providing assistance to people experiencing homelessness. Our programs include an emergency shelter, single adult supportive housing, and family supportive housing, and we strive to find affordable housing for all families. In 2019, we worked with 271 families and 593 children. Unfortunately, there are more children experiencing homelessness than adults in Minnesota. At Simpson Housing, early childhood specialists go into the home and provide services centered around the health and well-being of the child, as well as parent education and parenting support. Many of the parents that we work with have come from foster homes, may not have completed high school, and may have a life history of homelessness and poverty. They might not have had a healthy parent role model, or they might not understand what children need for healthy development. One of the ways that we hope to interrupt the generational cycle of homelessness is by partnering with parents to support children's success and stability and well-being through the home visiting model. Using this model, we're able to provide parent education and assist parents in establishing healthy and safe environments to ensure their children are ready for kindergarten. We have learned when parents know better, they do better. Ultimately, we want to increase access to these voluntary services to families that are interested and increase family home visiting resources. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Robinson, for your testimony and for your work. Joel of Flatton, you're our last testifier in this, if you could identify yourself. Okay, please,
yeah. And members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Flatton. I'm the executive director for Supporting Hands Nurse Family Partnership, which is a 20-county collaborative offering the Nurse Family Partnership home visiting program to first-time pregnant mothers and their families. Providing quality home visiting programs in rural communities is essential, as there are limited services that provide intensive supports to this targeted population. The mothers and families we work with deal with multiple issues such as mental health, substance abuse, isolation, and past trauma. Our nurses have definitely seen an increase in the mental health concerns over this past year. We know COVID has had a disproportionate impact on families. More families are facing housing and food instability and are feeling more isolated. Additional resources and attention to these families will be critical as we build back from the pandemic. Our goals are to empower mothers and families to support their child's cognitive development, improve health outcomes, and work towards self-sufficiency through education and employment. We know our home visiting program makes a positive impact in the lives of families we serve, as told by our nurses through numerous stories of helping mothers and families. In many instances, sadly, this is the first positive adult relationships these mothers and families have had. We hope the legislature will continue to support funding for home visiting so that these programs can continue to impact healthy futures for our families, for families. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Appreciate all the testifiers. And so with that, we've got a little bit of time for questions from members about this. And I should have said at the outset that I'd spoken with Representative Bonner and really have talked to some other folks too, but really wanted to make sure that we are hearing from folks who work in the early childhood field about the need in this area. What is the actual need that's out there? So, in any case, Representative Juergens, we'll go to you and to Chair Dabney. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a comment and a question for Ms. McDonald. First of all, thank you very much for being here today and for telling us your story. And I'm curious, you know, whether you have a child at 14 or 24 or 34, the second child, you always know a little bit more about what you're doing. And you mentioned that you're married now and have another child. Can you give us some idea of how raising your second child as compared to the first child, based on what you learned from the help that you got?
Ms. McDonald.
Yes. Well, the first time, you know, I did have the home visiting services and I learned so much about brain development and child behaviors and, you know, things like that. So for raising my second child, I had him when I was 20 and I just knew, I feel like I was better prepared for my home visiting experiences just to know about, you know, what was going on with him at each stage. I was better prepared to know, you know, certain behaviors, you know, are normal. You know, he's not doing this just to, you know, be naughty or things like that. Like certain things, you know, if the child does in my family, we're taught, like, you know, they're being naughty or this, that, and that. And some things are just developmental, you know, they can't express themselves. And I learned that, you know, don't treat children like little adults. You know, you have to treat them like, you know, children who have to learn how to manage their emotions. And I feel like that helped me out so much. It helped build my patience for being a parent. You know, so that is what helped me. I feel like, you know, now I was better equipped to handle my second son because I feel like I had, you know, this knowledge from all my work. And then on top of that, to this day, I still have some of the handouts that my public health nurses gave me. I still do. They're like 12 years old and I still go to them sometimes. I keep them in a little box in my closet because it helps out so much when I have to just go back to that and see it and just remind myself of certain things. So I hope that answered your question.
It did. Thank you very much. And thank you also for choosing the line of work that you did where you can help the other mothers as you were helped when you were younger.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Representative Juergens. And Chair Dabney, we'll move to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't want to take us too far off, but I want us to look forward. So a question from Ms. Robinson from Simpson Housing. Currently, there are eviction moratoriums.
Yes.
During the pandemic. And I understand that those are protective for folks who are most vulnerable right now in terms of their housing. Absolutely. There's a lot of push by many to eliminate Governor Walz's emergency authority immediately, to repeal the work that the federal government has done in eviction moratoriums. What does, I trust Simpson has looked forward as to what impact that might have on our communities. Can you speak to that at all?
I can a little because I worked in the early childhood program, but understand that this moratorium is going to have, the end of it is going to have different results for a lot of our families. A lot of our families lost employment during the during this COVID, so they weren't able to even save money or you know, earn a living to be able to pay for their their rent. And that is something that we really are concerned about. We have several people that are working toward helping those families that are going to be in that situation. And we do have quite a few that are going to be in that situation just because they weren't able to pay their rent during or save that money. Now, that's how we started out talking to them is, you know, save what you can. So at the end of this, that you'll be able to, you know, repay the rent because that's what's going to happen. We also are looking at this side of the landlords, too, because they are the ones that are providing housing for us. And they are in trouble, too, because they, you know, they weren't able to collect rents for our families. But we do have people in the organization that are working toward that. There's several programs out there that we are being connected with to be able to hopefully help some of that subsidy with our parents. But it is going to be, it is something that we're not looking forward to because it's going to be confusing for parents and, you know, and families. It's going to be a hardship for both the landlords that we're working with and for the families that we have. So, but we are working toward trying to prepare for that.
Jim Debbie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Robinson. I know from talking with other professionals in the field who work with families, young families, that they're anticipating, and to quote them, a tsunami of homelessness when those emergency orders are lifted, if we don't anticipate and plan for that. And to come into this committee's jurisdiction, the impact we know of homelessness on young children is significant. So just have that in mind as Ms. Robinson has discussed. So thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Dabney. Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment to the testifiers. Thank you specifically to Ms. McDonald. Thank you for sharing your story. The fact that you worked your way out of poverty and changed the legacy and trajectory for you and your family is very commendable. I just wanted to say, knowing how hard it can be to be a single mom, well done, and thank you for sharing your story this morning.
Thank you, Representative Damuth. I've got Representative Pryor, Representative Patizawood, too, and I'd ask you both if you can be extremely quick because I want to be able to move on to some other things. But Representative Pryor?
So this doesn't have to be a question that's answered right now, but maybe something that we can get more information on in the future. But what I'm interested in is I know what's hard, especially when we're talking about prenatal, how you can connect with these mothers-to-be to make sure that they're getting the full benefit of all the services. So I understand that that actually has been kind of a barrier to, you know, really rolling this program out in a way that is in, you know, really would benefit so many more people. So, you know, just as more data in the future, you know, how we can make sure that we're connecting with more future parents, future mothers. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe this is something we can just have Ms. LaCroix-DeLune and others get back to us on then, if that's okay. And then Representative Katiza-Witum, you'll have the final question or comment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a very quick comment. You know, I think that these home visiting programs are so, so important. And over the summer when I had my baby, I just received one in-home visit from a nurse postpartum to check on the baby, check on me. And I think that, those first few weeks after you have a baby, you're not really able to move around very well. And I think that, you know, having these programs where somebody's coming to your home, where you have somebody's number to text them, to call them with questions, I think that can be so impactful. And obviously, I can't speak to the entire curriculum that these services cover, but I just think that being able to build that relationship, that consistent relationship with somebody and know that they're going to come to you, that you don't have to just try to figure out how to get out the door some days is the hardest part of that postpartum period. So I appreciate all the work and I'm happy to support this. Thank you.
Thank you so much. What I think I'd like to do, if it's okay, Representative Bonner and all, is to move to, so there's a bill that will be in front of us that is kind of a companion to this proposal in a way. And so what I'd like to do is ask Representative Pryor to move House File 1197, which is a proposal from Representative Bonner, to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. And Representative Bonner, if you could please describe your proposal to us, then I know that you have a testifier and we can, it'll kind of continue, round out our home visiting conversation.
Yes, we'll be much more brief on this occasion because we're still talking about this tremendous program of home visiting. But I appreciate the opportunity to present HF 1197. Again, I won't revisit all of the virtues of home visiting once again, but rather provide just a brief outline of this more modest proposal before you. And I want you to understand that the contrast is stark and real. The bill we just discussed met 100% of the need for Minnesota families already on the edge in the best of times. The current proposal, in the time of even more need due to the pandemic, covers only the original 10% of families in need, leaving the other 90% behind. This bill is budget neutral. It maintains the existing state funding at $33 million for the biennium, and the bill does a couple of important things worth noting. First, it moves session law into statute under a new title. Second, it allows up to 25% of funding to be used to support family home visiting programs that are evidence-informed and promising practices programs. This is often culturally appropriate programs that are in that really have great promise. Third, it provides definitions for evidence-based, evidence-informed, and promising practice home visiting programs to make it crisp and clear. And four, it outlines the key outcomes associated with family home visiting programs. And Mr. Chair and members, with that, I would like to ask our testifiers to briefly speak to the policy changes.
I think we have just one, Ms. LaCroix de Lune, if you can please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laura LaCroix de Lune, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Coalition for Targeted Home Visiting. We are very excited to have this bill before the committee and for you to consider these important policy changes. This is not the first time this committee has heard these policy changes, nor is it the first time, hopefully, that the committee will pass these policy changes. We have moved forward this bill for the last few years and have last year in 2020, we got caught in COVID and it did not move forward with all the other changes. And in 2019, we moved forward and in the final budget negotiations, it didn't move to the Senate as well as the House for the last 2 years. So we are hopeful that we can move across the finish line this year and make these policy changes final. But this bill will give us an opportunity, as Representative Bonner had said, to really reach into communities that might not be served by evidence-based programs. And while we don't want to go into the weeds, we don't have time, what we believe will happen is we'll have access to more culturally relevant programming and programming that's really specific for a specific population, such as justice-involved families. So when a family's in jail and you want to start some home visiting, we need to use some adaptations of models, which are evidence-informed models and or adaptations that are promising practices. Or if we are working with families who are highly mobile and homeless and not able to get into a shelter, you can start the home visiting services while they are moving around. And so we can continue on those services if we make some of these policy changes. I know we are short on time. I'm happy to respond to any questions that members might have either here today or offline at another point in time. So thank you very much for considering this.
Thank you, Ms. LaCroix de Lune. And again, as was mentioned, those who've been on this committee in the past have heard this proposal, and in fact, passed this in previously. So it's hopeful to me that folks have some familiarity with it. And as was emphasized, the appropriation listed at the bottom is, in fact, budget neutral. It's simply putting an appropriation that's been in session law and putting that, making it be an ongoing thing, which, again, it has been. Any questions about this? And again, members, we will be voting on this. And again, many of us have heard this before, but just wanna make sure. Looking to see if we do. We'll give just a minute. Okay, not seeing anything. Representative Bonner, we'll give you any final word on this. Doesn't seem to be too many questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. clearly the need is tremendous in this area, and we know that the benefits and the return on our investment is incredible with home visiting. And, you know, we have seen in the last year some really stark consequences that have occurred as a result of COVID. And I think the need is even greater now. And so I hope, members, that you will, in fact, support this proposal to make sure that we can do right by our little ones and give them the start that they truly deserve to thrive and not just survive.
Thank you so much, Representative Bonner. And with that, Representative Pryor renews her motion, House File 1197, be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Ms. Chambers, if you could please take the roll on House File 1197.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Aye.
Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Aye.
Representative Franson.
No.
Representative Bennett.
Aye.
Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Representative Daniels.
No.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Damon.
Aye.
Representative Juergens.
Aye.
Representative Cotiza-Witun.
Aye.
Representative Morrison.
Aye.
Representative Wazlowit.
Aye.
And Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
We have 11 ayes and 2 nays.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Bonner. And thank you to all the testifiers. This is just tremendous, tremendous work that you all are doing. And I guess a particular thank you is to Ms. McDonald again, but to all of our testifiers. And so, members, we've heard this presentation about how to meet the actual need in home visiting. That was our first presentation. Then we heard and just passed this proposal to make sure that the money that we're spending right now is being used as effectively as possible and in as many ways to reach folks as possible. And so then finally, for home visiting today, we're going to hear about a really terrific home visiting program. Comes at things from a slightly different angle. And really glad to welcome Representative Joachim to our committee. If Representative Pryor, you could move to bring House File 617 before the committee.
So moved, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Representative Joachim, to you and your testifiers, welcome. Please begin presenting your bill, and we'll go from there.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. It's so nice to be in front of Early Childhood Committee again, and thank you for all your work you do for our youngest learners. And thank you for hearing House File 617. This bill would appropriate money for the Parent Child Plus Home Program. I'm joined here today by Jewish Family and Children's Services. JFCS provides a broad range of social services for people of all ages and backgrounds. In 2006, JFCS was working right here in their own backyard, partnering with St. Louis Park Public Schools in their elementary program. They quickly saw a critical need for a new early childhood intervention centered around access to quality early learning opportunities, especially for our low-income families in our community. JCFC searched for programs with proven outcomes and selected the Parent Child Plus Home Program that focuses on literacy. There are proven outcomes for children in the Parent Child Plus program compared to their socioeconomic peers. They are 50% more likely to be ready for kindergarten, 50% less likely to be referred to special ed services by grade 3, and 30% more likely to graduate from high school. Once the JFCS started the Parent Child Plus program, it quickly grew to meet a regional need. Soon after, the Promise Neighborhood of Central Minnesota reached out to partner with JFCS. And with one-time money in 2017, JFCS expanded Parent Child Plus to St. Cloud, Rice County, and Rochester. The expansion was very successful, and we're here today to ask for funding to continue the work in communities across the state. What you see in House File 617 is an increase to the program's base funding to make this expansion a reality. I know your time is tight, so I just have a few folks here to explain the benefits and describe the program here with me today. Christy Murray, the program manager for Parent Child Plus in Minneapolis. Armin Baldemlik, executive director from IMAA Rochester, Leslie Lamone, director from Rice County Parent Child Plus, and Lee Friedman, chief operating officer at JFCS Minneapolis. I know you have a full agenda, so I'm asked them to be brief, and they will be here for questions afterwards.
Thank you so much, Representative Joachim. Christy Murray, please identify yourself, your affiliation for the record, and proceed.
Good morning. I am Christy Murray. I'm the program manager of Parent-Child Plus. Thank you, Committee Chair Pinto, and thank you, Chief Sponsor, Representative Joachim. You've been a strong supporter of us for a long time. Parent-Child Plus is an international program with over 50 years of proven success for families that are served. Jewish Family and Children's Services of Minneapolis started Minnesota's first replication site here in 2006. This is a home visiting program that promotes creative ways to learn and acquire language through play. It enhances parenting skills and connects parents to resources in the community and helps the children that are served in the program and their families be ready for school success. As indicated by the name, Parent-Child Plus focuses on parents being their children's first and most important educator in their lives. This Parent-Child Plus is an equity-focused, designed program proven to reduce the opportunity gap. Families who are eligible for the program have incomes either at or below 200% federal poverty guidelines. We work with families that have young children, starting with them when their children are 18 months to 2.5 years old, at the time when language is first developing. And it is a 2-year program. It's an intensive home visiting program. We have trained early learning specialists that provide home visits twice a week for those 2 years for 30 minutes for each visit. Staff are able to provide both the home visits and all written materials in the languages of the families, in English, Somali, and Spanish. When we needed to quickly pivot for COVID, and we were able to develop this program into a virtual home visiting model. Each week, we are providing educational books and toys that are the family's tools to keep for their lifetime of learning. And I brought a couple of examples. I've got some examples on the shelves behind me, and I've got many more. My kids were really excited to see all of these coming home. But you can see we have high-quality, interactive toys that work on all the different skills that you would need to be able to help your kids get prepared for school. And as I mentioned, we are able to provide our books. This is probably a favorite of many of yours, The Hungry Caterpillar. And we're also able to provide our books in Spanish as well, too. And this program, we, as mentioned, we have been serving the Twin Cities metro area since we started in 2006. And then with the funding we got from the Minnesota Department of Education, we were able to expand to Cass County. And then more recently, we were able to expand to St. Cloud, Rochester, and Rice County. This year, even during a pandemic, we know that families still need this program, and we were able to serve 347 children. 223 of them were here in the Twin Cities metro area, and our newest partners, many of them grew their programs during a global pandemic, and they are able to serve 124 children this year. 94% of the families that we are working with are people of color or from Indigenous communities, and specifically, as I mentioned, we are able to provide these services with staff that speak Somali and Spanish as well too, because 42% of our families that we are working with identify as Somali, and 27 of them identify as Latinx. And we're very excited to be able to be before this committee and share the great work of this program. And I'll turn it over to the other testifiers. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And we'll have our next testifier from Rochester. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Armin Budemlich, and I'm Executive Director for the Intercultural Mutual Assistance Association. We are a premier service provider for refugees and immigrants in southeastern Minnesota. Being a first-generation refugee from Bosnia and Herzegovina and a father of two children, what I appreciate about Parent-Child Program is the following three things. First, it is a voluntary program, meaning parents have the ultimate choice of participating. Second, it's an evidence-based program, and it has proven track record of success. And third, this is not an expense on a financial statement, but it is an investment in the future of our families. Like all of the other locations across the state of Minnesota, our parent-child program is integrated with other IMA services providing whole family approach. Last year, IMA was able to serve 15 families. This year, we are serving 25 families. We continue to build capacities to serve additional families in the future. In closing, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I respectfully invite you to make this investment in our families.
Thank you so much, Mr. Bedinglich. Thank you. And Ms. Limon, you are up next. If you can identify yourself and please proceed.
Hello, everyone. It's such a good day, and it's such an honor to be here today with you. My name is Leslie Limon, and I'm the Parent-Child Plus Director in Rice County. We serve two cities, Northfield and in Faribault. This is our second year in the Parent-Child Plus program. In our first year, we served 15 children. In the second year, we're serving 53. Big increase. It's been great. We have bilingual staff, English, Spanish, and we also have a lot of the majority of our families are Spanish speaking, Somali speaking. Through this program, we've been able to provide laptops so that way the family are able to do virtual visits, review visits. And this program has benefited our not only the children, but the families overall in general. We've been able to identify many barriers. One of those examples can be when in the home when we do virtual visits, we ask the families how they're doing, if there's any assistance that they may need. And there is definitely a lot of need. We've been able to connect families to childcare assistance, to preschools within the community. Not only that, but provide other resources such as energy assistance. And we've been able to guide the parents through that process. And currently we have a waiting list for fall 2021. So we're excited to keep adding on more children, and they're able to learn and to engage, and we're able to model for the families what learning should look like, what play should look like. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thanks for your great work for kids. And finally, Mr. Friedman, if you can please identify yourself and welcome. Proceed.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Thank you, Representative Joaquim, for being our chief sponsor and your support of the program. And thank you, all committee members. I just briefly want to mention something about results and then just to explain the funding situation we're in with the program and this opportunity to keep it going across greater Minnesota. Representative Joaquim already mentioned some of the really key results and outcomes for children and parents that are in this program and that have been achieving those results across the country and in other countries actually for over 50 years now. So I won't get into that other than to say that we work closely with the Department of Education. We have been for many years helping to refine and make sure the program is working well. We report extensively on outcomes that are measured with parents and with children throughout the program year, and we can certainly make those full reports that we provide to the Department of Education available to all committee members if you would like to see them. And one other data point on outcomes, one of our private funders, this is a private-public partnership, and one of our newest private funders, the Constellation Fund, provided a benefit cost analysis of the program. And they determined that for every $1 spent on this program, the return on investment is $4.66. And that is seen through increased academic achievement, subsequent increased lifetime earnings for children participating in the program. The base funding increase that we're requesting is needed to sustain recent expansion in greater Minnesota. The current level of our base funding is $1.8 million per biennium. We received a one-time appropriation to scale up in greater Minnesota. That was passed in 2017, and we're using the funds through this year. We've successfully scaled up with these tremendous partners, some of which you've been able to hear from today, and we've added our sites in Rochester, St. Cloud, and Rice County. The program cost per family per year is down to $4,200. It was previously about $5,000, and we've worked hard to achieve economies of scale as we've grown the program. So tremendous results for that money. The base funding covers about 215 families per year, 215. And as you heard, we're currently serving 347 children thanks to the one-time expansion funds. So with the file, we would request the increase to $3 million in our base funding per biennium, which would enable us to hold on to the gains we've made with the opportunity that you, the legislature, and the Department of Education gave us, and also continuing to work with our private funders, which include the Schultz Family Foundation and the Constellation Fund. Thank you for your time today, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you much, so much, Mr. Friedman, and thanks to all the testifiers, Representative Joachim. Questions, members, about parent-child home? This will be laid over for possible inclusion in our budget bill, just to make sure folks are aware of that. The questions that folks have. Representative Juergens.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real briefly to Representative Joachim, what other programs, maybe I missed this in the presentation, but what other funding supports does this program receive? Any federal programs or from any other sources?
Is it Joachim or a testifier? I'm not sure.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Juergens. I think I'll kick that over to Lee Friedman.
Mr. Friedman.
Thank you, Representative Juergens. So the biggest portion of the funding for the program does come through the legislature and then through the Department of Education. But we also receive private funding and are regularly seeking support of both individual donors and foundations, most locally based, including the Schultz Foundation, the Constellation Fund. We previously had funding from the Greater Twin Cities United Way, and we continue to seek that kind of support to make sure that we can sustain the program at its size in the Twin Cities and across Greater Minnesota.
Representative Juergens?
Thank you. That's it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I should note for members, I'm just looking to see if there are other questions, that it's maybe part of the fragmentation of the area that we work in. We've heard home visiting presentations up till now in this hearing that are actually funded through the Department of Health. This is a program that's aimed especially at literacy and is funded through the Department of Education. But of course, it's all about child development too. And so one of the things, and I appreciate both Representative Joachim and the testifiers, we've had conversations just trying to think that through about how to make sure that we're providing support in general for these terrific home visiting programs. This is one that's doing just phenomenal work. We want to make sure that it can, that work can continue, if not expand, but certainly we wouldn't want to go backwards. So just so folks kind of have a sense of that. So looking to see if there are other questions. I am not seeing others. And so Representative Joachim will give you the chance for final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the discussion, your time, and your attention this morning. Parent Child Plus not only helps parents connect with their child, but also to become more engaged in their child's education. And we know that once that parent is engaged in their child's education, their child's future is so much brighter. So, members, I ask for your support of House File 617.
Thank you so much, Representative Joachim. Thanks again to you all for this terrific program. So with that, the chair lays over House File 617 for a possible inclusion in our committee's budget bill. Thank you so much again. And with that, Representative Pryor, you are up with the bill, House File 1466. Would you like to move that that be recommended for placement on the general register?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 1466 be placed on the general register.
And then you have an author's amendment, Representative Pryor, is that correct?
I do. It's, again, just a technical cleaning up the bill a little bit in the language and making it all work.
Okay. And so, Representative Pryor, you would like to move the A2 author's amendment?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And any questions about that? It's, as Representative Pryor said, it's technical, putting the bill in the form she wishes. Not seeing any. All in favor of approval of the A2 author's amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any opposed? Okay, so the motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. The bill is in the form that you wish. Representative Pryor, if you can describe the bill to us, and then I think you've got one testifier.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll just try to briefly put the context for this. This bill is needed because it removes confusion about how 119B matches up with other laws, and these changes are technical in nature. There is one policy provision that could impact a few certified centers going forward, but does result in treating them the same as other provider types and was agreed on by multiple stakeholders. I do have a testifier, Lori Poisson from the department will explain more.
Okay, good. Thank you. Yeah, Ms. Poisson, you can identify yourself and proceed. And maybe just to confirm that this is a proposal from the department. As was described by Representative Pryor. But yeah, please, Ms. Poisson.
Good morning. I am Lori Poisson. I'm the manager of the Child Care Assistance Program at the Department of Human Services. Thank you for taking up this bill this morning. And yes, it is the governor's proposal, a policy proposal that is primarily cleanup in nature. So Representative Pryor, thank you, and members of the committee. I'll just walk through section by section, kind of the highlights and the intent, and then I'll stop to see if there are questions. So section one of the bill is clarification language. It just clarifying that there is no threshold to collect, minimum threshold to collect fraud payments. So there's a lot of striking and new words in there, but the net result of that is that any fraud overpayment is an overpayment regardless of the amount. Secondly, the changes clarify the department's authority to collect overpayments the way that counties and tribes do. The department right now only collects provider overpayments, and this already matches existing laws. Some of the issues are that there's cross matching with 245E, for example, and another area of 119B. So this solves any confusion. And then under 245E, which is sort of what the amendment was about, the amendment was to clarify that if the department were ever to pursue a family overpayment, which we, in the 15 years I've been around, have not done, it would only be when there's an investigation that's come underway from DHS. In other words, the business of family overpayments stays with counties almost always and still will. Okay. Section two is a cleanup. Since 2016, we have not been doing provisional payments, which were allowed under previous state law. The federal law said we can't pay providers till they've cleared a background study. A few counties used to do that. They don't anymore. This just codifies that. So section two works in combination with section five. Section three is specifying that that when a provider has a conditional license, that the department will not or a county will not take an action. This was old language. I think it was written in 2011. We met with stakeholders and really decided, you know, conditional licenses are meant to support providers returning to compliance, and it's not a good idea to stop them from getting reimbursed while they're working on their conditions of their license. So, again, nobody has been doing this for, actually, I don't think it ever got used. The policy change is that certified centers have a different section of statute to become a certified center. What we were missing was the element of turning off a payment if a certified center is operating under a suspended or revoked license. CCAP has the authority to stop paying when providers go into that status, and we want certified centers to be treated the same way. Then the language about payments stop when there's a fraud investigation and when fraud has been established. We just hold payments. We stop payments while there are, for instance, an action taken and a possible appeal. This is just clarifying that payments do stop, and it's not that the funds are moving. They're just stopping, and they are held over so that a family can the family doesn't lose their funding, just that provider. Which might be, and it might be reversed if like a due process action is upheld or reverses a decision. Sorry. So section four, just a clarification again with a different section of law about how absent days and holiday billings do result in, if they're done incorrectly, they do result in overpayments. And again, that's in another section of 119B. So it's just making it consistent. And then Section 5 has to do with a provisional payment, the interaction between those two pieces, clarifying there's no more provisional payments. Oh, I'm sorry. I am sorry. I reversed this. The first thing in Section 5 is that there's a repealer because we had a another part of 119B that is a better statement about federal authority. It's just a cleanup because it caused confusion over which part do you use when you cite federal authority. So 119B06 is the better statement. And then the provisional payment is that last piece. So with that, I'll just stop and see if there are questions.
Okay, and again, members, we will be voting on this to send it to the floor. Look to see if there are questions from members about it. Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Ms. Poison, for your testimony here. I'm just a little confused. I saw a minimum of $50 was the amount used for, I'm not sure if that starts, I'm a little confused. Does that start an investigation? Does that stop the payment process? Where did that $50 amount come from? It seems kind of low if you're going to start an investigation or do a clawback. That just seemed to me pretty low figure. So could you explain that so I understand it?
No. Thank you for the question, Representative and members. The $50 language was in law previously. It just meant that when it wasn't fraud, a county could choose not to pursue a $50 over, like a $40 overpayment. But it couldn't be fraud. This is just clarification language that there is no minimum for fraud. So it really has nothing to do with investigations or any other action. It's just the county, when the county sets up the overpayment, they were allowed to kind of dismiss something less than $50 when it was not fraud. And this is just clarifying that can't apply to a fraud situation.
Representative Daniels, is that helpful to you?
Just a quick comment. I think I understand it now. I appreciate your response. So we're not starting an investigation if it's $50 or more. I mean, if it's $50, we're not starting an investigation. That's just an amount used to start looking at situation. Is that correct?
Ms. Poussin, I think it's slightly different tracks, but Ms. Poussin.
Correct. Thank you, Representative Daniels. I'll try to answer that because investigations are really handled by OIG and by counties, but this is just about collecting the money. So counties and attorneys and fraud investigators and OIG determine when they're going to, you know, what's the threshold. It's not just dollars. It's kind of the patterns of you know, problems or fraud, potential fraud. This is only about the money. Like when a determination has been made, like if a policy was violated, but it wasn't fraud, I'll just use the example. If there was one absent day and it was $20 on that day, we might collect it, but we would not. That might not be fraud if it was one day out of 100. But once there's a pattern and then it becomes bigger, the pursuit of the overpayment just goes to this section of statute to determine if it's going to be collected. $50, the threshold if it's not fraud, but if it's fraud, it has zero and up. Every dollar needs to be attempted to be collected.
Representative Daniels, are you?
I'm fine, Chair. Thank you very much.
Okay. No problem. I'll just note, because I hadn't looked at this very much, Representative Daniels, your question was helpful. I mean, as I read this under current law, if a family receives an overpayment of $51, current law requires that the state seek to recover the $51. And if the family is not able to pay, right, is not able to do sort of through a voluntary repayment, the state actually is required to bring a court action right now. So a family maybe has had no involvement with fraud or anything. There was this overpayment. I suppose that was an overpayment to the benefit of the family. I suppose the money would have gone to the child care provider, and the family then could have a court action against them if it's $51 under current law. Is that right, Ms. Mosin, as I'm reading this?
Representative Pinto, others, no, not really. Okay. It just, we're the department for a family overpayment, the counties are required to collect, attempt to collect it. There's not a court action. It would either just be we have a recoupment statute. There's recoupment and recovery as methods to get the money back. When most often, if a family, say they got a benefit, $51 that they were found not to be eligible for, that just comes out of their benefits without a court action.
And Ms. Pocino, I was looking at the sentence beginning on line 2.2, but I do note, and again, this is current law. This has nothing to do with your bill, so I probably should drop it. I was just noting current law, but it does say that that there's not a court action if the cost to recover the overpayment will exceed the amount. And again, that's current law. That was passed by the legislature in the past. We won't worry about that.
Oh, I see.
Right now. Yeah. Or Ms. Pocino, you got a comment on what I said?
Oh, I just wanted to clarify, I'm sorry, Representative, I just wanted to clarify that you don't need a court action to collect an overpayment.
So any further questions, though, about the actual bill language as opposed to me taking us down this other path? My apologies, members and all. I'm not seeing hands raised. So Representative Pryor, before we vote, you, as usual, get the last word.
Thank you for your support, committee members. There is that one policy change, but it's not controversial among the stakeholders, the providers, and otherwise it's just cleaning up some language and statute and making it all consistent. So thanks for your support.
With that, members, Representative Pryor renews her motion that House File 1466 be recommended for placement on the general register. Ms. Chambers, if you can please take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Aye.
Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Aye.
Representative Franson.
Aye.
Representative Bennett.
Aye.
Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Representative Daniels.
Aye.
Representative Dabney. Representative Dabney. Representative Damon.
Aye.
Representative Juergens.
Juergens, aye.
Representative Cotiza Watoon.
Aye.
Representative Morrison.
Aye.
Representative Waslowick.
Aye.
Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
Representative Dabney. There's 12 ayes and one abstain.
Thank you, members. With that, the motion prevails. House File 1466 is recommended for placement on the general register. Thank you, Representative Pryor. And then to our final bill today, House File 1036. Representative Waslowick, would you like to move that bill to place it before the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I will move House File 1036 to be in front of the committee.
Thank you. And with that, please present your bill, and then we'll move to your testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, as some of you may know, Representative Damuth and I served on the Family Child Care Task Force and helped put together recommendations to make the family child care system in Minnesota more welcoming and efficient for providers and in turn for families that rely on them. One of the task force's key recommendations was to modernize the family child care licensing system and create a new risk-based system in our state. I'm carrying a bill to do that, and this bill mirrors that effort, but for child care centers as opposed to family child care. While some things in the child care world are specific to family child care centers, family child care or centers, the need for updated regulations is not one of those things. These regulations are three decades old, and it's time to update them in a more comprehensive manner. House File 1036 would provide funding for DHS to contract with an organization to develop a proposal for revised licensing standards for child care centers. This process would involve extensive stakeholder engagement, which would provide the opportunity to hear from a cross-section of providers and others impacted by these changes in order to understand how the current regulations do or do not relate to and support child health and safety in the context of best practices. It is my hope that both the family child care and the child care center regulation modernization bills move forward this session so that we'd be able to sort of run concurrent processes for both those fields, noting there might be good synergy and potential cost savings from doing both simultaneously. The ultimate goal here is to reform our licensing system so that child care provider frustration is decreased. Information for parents and families is clearer and more meaningful, and the folks who are doing the actual regulation feel that they have better tools with which to do their work. So with that brief introduction, I will turn it over now to my testifier, Ms. Jaquit.
Thank you so much, Representative Wozlik. Before we do that, I just, as Representative Wozlik noted, we're sort of coming at this a little bit backwards, members, in the sense that Representative Wozlik co-chaired and Representative Gameth served on a family child care task force. Just the way that scheduling has worked, we're kind of putting the recommendations from the task force and report from it still at a future meeting, which we have not reached yet, but we will be, and that's incredibly important, and our family child care providers do such critical work for us. And what came out of that was a recommendation for modernizing the regulations for family child care. So again, we're going to be hearing about that. This is then what came out of that was a parallel proposal for child care centers. So again, my apologies, members, is a little bit backwards in that way, but hopefully makes sense to everyone. So we're going to turn to Ms. Jaquith then. If you can please identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Wozlik. My name is Kristen Jaquith. I'm the director and CFO of Stay and Play Child Care. We have two centers serving Meeker and Kandy, Ohio counties. I'm also a board member of the Minnesota Child Care Association. My centers serve up to 300 children between the ages of 6 weeks and 12 years. We are open from 5 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. year-round, serving working families. We're four-star parent aware rated. We rely on a mix of parent tuition, child care assistance, and early learning scholarships for our revenues. This past year has been exhausting, difficult, and honestly scary at sometimes to operate a child care center. But I am grateful for this committee's attention to our field and addressing our needs. The Minnesota Child Care Association supports HF 1036 because we are beyond due for an update to our licensing regulations. We work on regulatory issues for centers statewide, and over the past several years have supported reforms related to discrete issues. This year, when our board discussed our 2021 legislative priorities, we agreed that there wasn't progress to be made in a piecemeal approach. The entire system needs to be overhauled and brought to the 21st century and be more workable for providers, parents, and the children that we're serving. We're not interested in deregulation. Health, safety, and quality of our programs are the utmost concern. We're interested, however, in re-regulation. Modernizing the licensing rules with broad engagement from providers will help build a system more reflective of what we know are best practices for our children. Moving to a risk-based system would help reduce provider frustrations stemming from current systems and really would help make the punishment fit the crime, so to speak. All child care licensing records are publicly available online per federal law. And prospective families and current parents check these listings, and believe me, they often ask us about what they find. And they should have this access. They should ask the questions. They're leaving the care and early education of their most precious children with us, so it's important. But what they might find in today's system doesn't always give them the truest picture of us as providers. For example, a parent searching my child care licensing record will find a citation stating that hazardous materials were available to children. As a provider, I can tell you that a lot of parents won't look past that. Why would they? If they do choose to look a little deeper, they would find that the hazardous materials in that situation was exposed landscape fabric along the side of the building, causing a possible tripping hazard. Another citation in that visit we got was for a climber in the toddler room placed on the carpet, and the carpet doesn't have adequate fall protection. However, this was during nap time, and the equipment was moved to the side so cots could be placed out. Are these things that providers could remedy or fix? Of course, but that's not the same magnitude as leaving poisonous chemicals out in the reach of a child. Common sense shows these situations are completely different, posing different risks of harm. Providers have tons of examples of frustrating situations like mine. We don't like being made feel like we're doing something awful if we really truly haven't. But also parents need to see the seriousness or not of a situation in which we may fall short. I want to thank you for considering this bill. Please don't lose sight that while the current regulatory structure is frustrating, it causes nowhere near the stress of the financial difficulties that providers are facing right now. The child care regulatory system is not the only piece of child care needing an overhaul. Thank you for inviting me here today.
Thank you so much, Ms. Drapeway. Thanks for your testimony and for your just really important work for our young Minnesotans. We appreciate it. I know that so I believe that that's the only testifier, this bill is going to be the plan is to lay it over for possible inclusion. But questions, members, on House File 1036? Paul, I'm looking to see, I'm going to ask a question, Representative Wasilik, but I just was trying to figure out about the cost. I noticed that there is a blank appropriation at the end. I imagine you could have done it without that, and then it would have just been fiscal noted. But maybe if Mr. Berg would be able to help us with this, you can tell me. But what is your thinking about kind of what the cost of this will be, or how we'll figure that out?
So I believe a fiscal note was requested, but it hasn't come back yet. I got the email alert for that the other day, I think yesterday. So that is in the works. I can say that we have in the family child care bill, that's pretty much the same as this with a few tweaks to make it for family child care. The cost is $1.5 million. And that was based on conversations with the folks from NARA, which is the organization that does a lot of this work, that's done a lot of this work with other states. And sort of walking through the steps of the process that they go through and what that costs, and then using that figure from them, along with some conversation with DHS to give sort of a number, a ballpark number of what this costs. So that's the family child care piece. I imagine the cost might be similar for this, but if we were able to run sort of both the family child care and the center process at the same time, I imagine the cost would probably be a little bit lower if we were able to engage with those two processes at the same time.
That actually raises a couple questions for me. And again, members, feel free to raise hands. But the way the bill is structured, again, is with the appropriation built in the bill. But I assume that once we get the fiscal note back, then the idea would be that simply that's the number that would go in that blank. Is that correct? Or was there something else that you had in mind for the appropriation that's separate from what the fiscal note would come back with?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. I would rely on the fiscal note.
Okay. And then the other question is, do we have some mechanism to figure out if we're getting a fiscal note on your family child care bill and a fiscal note on the child care center bill, a way to figure out, this maybe is directed to Mr. Berg, but a way to figure out if what you say, Representative Wasilik, is correct, that if we were to do both, is there some, A plus B may actually end up being less than, or A and B might be less than A plus B, if you understand what I'm saying. Mr. Berg, perhaps, any thoughts on how we would address that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wasilik, I can put a note in the fiscal note to have the see if the department can comment on that as they go forward with the two fiscal notes, and we can also have some informal conversation with them. It may be possible to do that within the context of the fiscal note as well. The only other thing I would note is that on this one, with a blank in here, and also on the other one that has the cost in it, it allows the department to comment on their view of what the cost will be, plus it will identify the cost of administering the process as well, which will be some. So in both cases, we should get a fiscal note and it'll tell us where we're at.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. And then just one other question from me, which is, do we have a sense from anybody, Representative Wasilik, or anyone else, how my recollection is the family child care regulations date back to the 1980s, maybe the early 1980s, and a lot has changed since then. I don't know if that's similar with center-based regulations we're talking about in this bill, but I think they're quite, it's multiple decades old. Representative Wasilik, I don't know if you're aware of that, or perhaps Ms. Sanford, I think maybe on, but.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I don't know if they're exactly the same time period, but the child care, the center regulations are also several decades old. And have sort of been updated piecemeal, bit by bit, sort of similar to the family child care regulations. And so this is an attempt to try and actually make more of a comprehensive change instead of being little bits of pieces here and there.
Okay, good. Well, thank you. I am not seeing other hands raised, and so Representative Wasler will give you the final word on this proposal and move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing this bill today. And just want to sort of reiterate what we heard from our testifier today about the frustration that providers are feeling, having to sort of work through a system that hasn't had comprehensive updates in quite some time. So looking forward to continued discussion, and hopefully we can move this and the family child care piece forward and get some really good, make some really good progress on this regulation piece for our providers and our families. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wasilek. With that, the chair lays over House File 1036 for possible inclusion in our committee's budget bill. I will say, members, I'm feeling now a little bit guilty about having pushed quite so hard on our home visiting presentations earlier in our hearing, and so I hope you all will give a particular consideration to those to these tremendous programs. And I do want to clarify, because it sounds like I may have forgotten to do this, that House File 1197, I think the tally was announced, but to clarify that motion did pass and that bill has been re-referred to Health Finance and Policy Committee. And then just a couple quick notes about next week and beyond. Again, so we heard the proposal today regarding home visiting, and I really asked Representative Bonner and the folks that she's working with to share with us what is the actual need in that area. And as she pointed out, right now we're supporting about 10% of the low-income children and families who could be benefited. And so she shared the proposal to actually meet 100% of the need. We will be hearing a series of other proposals in other areas that we oversee in early childhood for that as well. It's obviously going to be our job to figure out how we can meet that need as best as we can. But it seemed important to at least understand what the actual need is. And so please expect that to be coming. And then again, really important, we hear from our Family Child Care Task Force that be important focus, and that's coming up as well. Please continue to be in touch. Thanks so much, members and all. And with that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.